Hello, if everyone can grab a seat, and welcome on behalf of the Aspen Institute. I think this is going to be a very interesting conversation, and in order to make sure that we get on our way over to the music tent, we're going to start right away. If everyone can silence their cell phones, that would be great, but if you feel the need or the desire to tweet during this, it is hashtag Aspen Ideas. So I'm going to hand it over to Renee Montaigne. And let it go from here.
All right. Well, let me introduce the rest of the panel. You no doubt know who they are because you've probably read your guide or you've got the app. But let me put faces to names again. We have on the panel, we have Germany's ambassador to the U.S., Peter Wittig. We just discussed pronouncing it V instead of W. And Ambassador Fred Hoff. He is the director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. We have with us also Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's the president and CEO of New America, also a professor emerita at Princeton. And Mohammed Ghanem, he is the senior political advisor, among other things, for the Syrian American Council. And I'd like to welcome the panel myself and welcome to all of you here today. We're just going to jump right in because an hour is not the even close to enough time to sort out anything about what the world should do about Syria. I'm sorry to say, actually, that there are no simple answers. But we're going to have some conversation here, some maybe no exact answers, but a lot of information about what's going on there that can give you something to work with when you're thinking about what you think about Syria and that part of the world. I'd like to start with something that was in the news recently. It was a big enough news item, but some of you might not have caught it. It was a diplomatic letter, what's known as a dissent memo, that was sent, put out, and leaked, as it turns out, because it wasn't intended to be public, signed by 51 American diplomats within the State Department, basically calling for some military action in Syria, the aim being, the letter said, to achieve some amount of leverage for the White House and for the U.S. That speaks to some extent what should the world do about Syria. So I'm going to put it to this panel, and maybe I should speak to... Maybe I'll begin with just arbitrarily, Anne-Marie, as to what you think, this letter, how you read it, what you think it was meant to achieve, and where it's going to go from there. And anybody else can pick up, obviously. This is a group conversation.
Thank you. So I sit here with very mixed emotions, in part the pleasure of seeing all of you, and in part knowing that this is the third Aspen Ideas panel I have sat on Syria. At least one of them with Fred Hoff, saying year after year, we have to do something, it's going to get worse, and it has gotten steadily, steadily, steadily worse. Someone said outside, I hope you're going to enlighten us, and I said, I'm not sure there's any hope or light on this subject, but we are going to try. That dissent letter... I used to be director of policy planning, and we managed the dissent channel. So it is not often used. It was put in place during the Vietnam War, after the Vietnam War, so diplomats could say, without fear of retaliation, that they thought their country was heading in a dramatically wrong direction. And that's what this was. These were all the diplomats like Fred who were on the ground who are saying what we are doing is not only not working, it's making matters worse. We have no leverage. You cannot achieve a bargain, a political settlement, because I don't think anybody thinks that we can win this on the ground. We have to have a political settlement. You cannot bargain with no chips, and we have no chips. We're not willing to use force. We're not willing to arm the opposition in any way that really makes a difference. We're not willing to put in a no-fly zone. We're willing to talk and talk. And Assad is winning while we talk, and the Russians are eating our lunch while we talk. So with that lovely, optimistic introduction to the subject, I will turn it to whomever wants to join it.
Yeah, I'll just add a few words about this. I left government service in late 2012, so I know roughly half of the people who signed this letter. I think it's important to understand what they were saying and what they were not saying. These are not 51 American diplomats who are in favor of invading and occupying Syria. No. These are not people who are in favor of violent regime change in Syria. No. They're not interested in a strategic bombing campaign. None of this. What they've put their finger on is the essence of the problem right now. And that essence is the protection of civilians. Civilians have been on the bullseye of the Assad regime and ISIS from the beginning of this process. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I know how Syria is going to turn out in the end. I don't think anybody in this room can do that. What I can say with perfect confidence, and I've been saying it, I'm sorry to say, for 5 years now, is that nothing good can happen in Syria as long as civilians are on the bullseye. This is a country, when this violence started in March 2011, there were 23 million Syrians in the country. Since then, over 5 million refugees, roughly 7 million internally displaced, upwards of 400,000 dead, countless additional people maimed seriously, traumatized for life. This country is emptying itself. It's emptying itself into the neighbors, and Europe has experienced a migrant crisis. So what these 51 are saying is we really need to consider some other means to impress upon Bashar al-Assad that there is a price to pay for slaughtering civilians at an industrial scale. Right now, there is no price, except for maybe aviation fuel, and even that is probably subsidized by Iran.
Can I just ask, so when you say a price to pay, and you made it very clear, as did this letter, that nobody, and as has everyone, Secretary of State Kerry, there are no boots on the ground, nobody's contemplating the sort of bombing that the Assad regime is doing, nobody's contemplating the sort of aerial bombardment that Russia is doing, nobody's sending in a general the way Iran is doing, extraordinarily gifted general, as a matter of fact, the Iranian Soleimani. The U.S. is not planning to do any of that. So what is the size of the price that's even possible to ask Assad to pay here?
What these folks recommended was basically the use of cruise missiles, okay? If there's a particularly egregious massacre, use cruise missiles, launch from the sea, perhaps, to hit a helicopter base, to take out some helicopters. This was their recommendation. I like the letter, okay? But to be perfectly honest with you, if I was the drafter, I wouldn't have gone there in terms of a specific recommendation. What I would have recommended is that the President of the United States turn to his Secretary of Defense and say, look, Ash, this is a tough problem. We can't defend everyone all the time in all places. I need to see some options, though, because what I want to see is a situation where Assad knows that every time he's going to think about doing something like this, there's a price to pay. Tell me what the risks are, but give me the options. I can assure everyone in this room that that has not happened to date. There have been times when the president has been very exasperated with senior officials who are bleeding all over him on the situation in Syria, and he said, okay, I'll listen to options. I've got an open mind. That is entirely different than the commander-in-chief making a specific, positive, pointed statement of intent to his Secretary of Defense, and I think that's really what's needed here.
Well, Mohammed Ghanem, let me put it to you. What at this moment, give us a sense of what the environment is like. What is the world doing now, in, as you understand it, about Syria?
Well, the U.S. and Russia co-chair a group called the International Syria Support Group. And this group is supposed to be in charge of a diplomatic track of trying to find a path towards a political solution for Syria. Unfortunately, Russia is in the driver's seat because the U.S., as my co-panelists have just mentioned, does not have any leverage, whereas Russia went into this with a lot of leverage because on September 30th, 2015, they sent troops, they sent jets, they went all in. So Secretary Kerry, who is trying to negotiate a political solution, doesn't have, which is the only thing that we're doing about the Assad, about the conflict in Syria, as far as Assad is concerned. The talks now exist largely on paper. They have collapsed. The Assad regime, there was a brief cessation of hostilities. They didn't even call it a ceasefire. So there was a brief cessation of hostilities, and that cessation of hostilities has collapsed. The regime was able to violate it at will. There was no enforcement mechanism, no UN monitoring team on the ground. The Russians recently introduced cluster munitions, white phosphorus, into the equation, especially in Aleppo. They're trying to besiege and take Aleppo, which is Syria's pre-war commercial capital, from the opposition. So we are now in a situation where we don't have a viable path towards a political solution because the Assad regime does not see reason why they should compromise. The Russians went in claiming that they were going after ISIS, but we now know from facts that that is not the case because the result of their bombing campaign is U.S.-backed moderate groups losing significant ground in the country. And groups such as Nusra, which is the Syrian al-Qaeda affiliate, which was not a party to the ceasefire, actually gaining ground and gaining momentum because almost all of the moderate opposition groups signed onto the ceasefire and they authorized the defected prime minister, Dr. Riyad Hijab, to negotiate in Geneva on their behalf. He's leading the opposition now. And so they signed onto the ceasefire, and sorry to say they were screwed over because they would be bombed during the day and there would be no consequence. The Russians would deny that the bombing happened, or they would say it wasn't them or it was not the Assad regime. And as Anne said and Fred said, no consequence. So why compromise at all? And then Bashar al-Assad gave a speech to his new rubber stamp parliament recently, about 2 weeks ago, and said, you know, in Geneva, we were talking to ourselves. There's no opposition. And we're going to fight and recapture every inch we have lost. So he was public about his intent, about his intention. And unless you change the facts on the ground, unless you build leverage, unless you have chips, I don't think you can get anywhere.
Let me just sneak in here, Peter Wittig, because I want to. I say that advice. I use that language advisedly because the Europe, Europe's. What is Europe's relationship to this entire situation?
Syria is the most intractable conflict of our time. It's probably the worst humanitarian disaster and the biggest human tragedy of our time. And I find it difficult as somebody who has served in the region and loves Syria to analyze the situation in an analytical and clinical sense while this unspeakable suffering is going on after 5 years of war and hundreds of thousands dead and, you know, half of the population displaced. Can I make a little look back, historical look back? I think there was an opportunity to contain that conflict early on in 2011 and 2012. I was serving on the Security Council as representative of Germany, and Syria was number one issue there. And we grappled with you know, the question, how can we help the Arab League, which was a factor at the moment, to contain that conflict, which was still a conflict, sort of a freedom movement against a repressive regime, the Assad regime, was brutally crushed. And what can the international community do at this stage to help? And we came up with a resolution to embrace this Arab plan and give it some teeth. And everybody was on board, with the exception of Russia and China. So if you one day look back and attribute historical responsibility, I think those veto powers that foiled this plan will bear some responsibility. And now and then, you know, from then on, the war morphed into an ethnic, religious, tribal, civil war and a proxy war, and is now much more difficult to solve. Now, in Europe, we are more preoccupied with the refugees. We're having this discussion. What is the price of military action? What is the price of military inaction? But it's mostly how can we grapple with this epic, almost biblical flow of refugees and migrants to Europe. And I think we're doing a couple of things that hopefully can alleviate the situation. First is humanitarian aid in a big way. I think my country is spending billions of it to alleviate the life of the refugees in Syria and in the region, basically in Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. And that has to continue. Secondly, try to stabilize those regions in Syria that are under the control of the opposition or have been reconquered by ISIL in rehabilitating the infrastructure so that people return to that region or have no incentive to flee anymore to Europe. And another element is, of course, participating in the military campaign against ISIL. But then there is this political track. I applaud Secretary Kerry for his relentless efforts to forge this international Syrian support group of 17 countries. Has it had great success? No. It has brought down, in a limited way, the hostilities, but it has not delivered on political progress. Is it time to call it a failure? I would say no. It's not the time. What would happen if we would give up? We are part of that. It would open the floodgates for the support of those countries in the region that are financing their proxies there. We would see an even more ferocious civil war there. So I'm not ready to give up on that political track. It has to be buttressed by other measures. The Russians basically are a key factor here, and I admit that. Secretary Kerry yesterday spoke about sort of a new paradigm that he hopes to find with Russia. I would warn to talk those efforts down. It's a worthy effort, and I think we need... in addition to all the other measures, we need a political solution in the end.
Can I jump in? Jump in, because I can see you shaking your head.
Well, so one response, and then sort of a reframing of this issue. You are absolutely right that remember, the opposition marches in Syria started in March 2011. It started with the torture of children in Daraa. The torture of children. That's what led people to take to the streets, and of course it was part of the larger Arab Spring. But it's worth remembering that that's the first trigger. They marched for 6 months without firing a shot. All the way through October, they got mowed down. The demonstrators, there was no use of force. It was not civil disobedience, nonviolence, very deliberately. They create the Free Syrian Army starting in November of 2011. It gets horrible very quickly. It comes to the UN in the winter of 2012. And yes, Russia vetoed it. Russia is culpable. But you know, when that happened in Kosovo, we acted. This time, we didn't. We being NATO. So it's not enough to just say it's on Russia. We saw it then. I wrote an op-ed in February of 2012 saying we need no-kill zones, and many other people did too. We saw it Just as we saw with Kosovo, when he emptied out Kosovo, we realized we had to act, and of course Russia was going to veto. So it's on us. It's on us, too. It's not only on us, but it is on us, too, because there is a time when you comply with international law, and there is a time when you realize you have to break it. And we did the right thing in Kosovo. We didn't do the right thing in Iraq. President Obama sees Iraq. I see Kosovo as the referent. But this is Aspen Ideas. Here's the idea you have to walk away from. We may not be able to fix Syria, or put it back together in any reasonable way. What is happening to Syrian civilians is not a humanitarian issue. It is not a humanitarian issue. It is a strategic issue. Because part of what's gotten us into this trouble is, oh, well, geopolitically, this isn't a strategic issue, and we don't have a dog in this fight. I mean, it's Russia and Iran, but Israel's okay. Saudi Arabia's okay. There's no strategic issue here. There's a big humanitarian issue, and we should take care of those poor people. No. This is a strategic issue for two major reasons. One, if you don't pay attention to what's happening to 22 million people, they leave, just as all of us would. We have now seen that stream of refugees affect Britain's vote to leave the EU. The order that we have built since 1945 is actually in peril. And the Syrian refugees are a huge part of that. It's not rational necessarily, but that's not we, the United States, right now, rationality and politics don't seem to be meshing in any particular way. Right? So one, if you don't pay attention to if you don't take care of people, they will leave. And where are they going to go? They're going to destabilize their neighbors, and ultimately they're going to go to the best place. But two, ISIS did not spring out of thin air. The people in Syria would not have supported ISIS unless they thought there was no other hope. Right? We are incubating yet another generation of people who hate us and will support people who try to kill us. And perfectly reasonably, because if you're a Syrian, it's not that we're not using force in Syria. We are using force in Syria. We are bombing. We're willing to send out our planes to bomb ISIS. We won't bomb a helicopter that is dropping chemical weapons or a barrel bomb on children. Oh, no. But we will certainly bomb ISIS. So if you're a Syrian and you're looking at the United States, who said Assad should go, but then stood by while he did unspeakable things to you, including using chemical weapons, and then you only were willing to use force when you thought you were directly threatened via ISIS, how would you feel? Right? We're incubating another generation of people who will support people who hate us. That is not a humanitarian issue. It's a strategic issue. And until we can see the protection of civilians as in a world that is as interconnected as ours is, whether by social media where ISIS can say lone wolves attack, or via refugees who use Facebook to get out of Syria and to get to Europe, we're not going to be able to address these problems. So it's regardless of what we happen, it is essential that you push back when people say, it is a humanitarian crisis, but if that's the way we keep thinking about it, we're just going to offer SOPs, and we are going to pay the price of a whole generation of millions of people who are now going to do us harm.
I actually couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. I actually couldn't agree more, and believe me, Anne, in 2014... about a year before there was even an international coalition to fight ISIS, before the U.S. had made a decision to bomb ISIS in Iraq or in Syria, Syrians in January and February 2014, before ISIS had captured Mosul, launched a battle against ISIS. They went to war with ISIS, and they pleaded with the U.S. for support, and they didn't get support. And I was personally involved in that. Went to the White House. Maybe we can get into that later later today, but. I just could not agree more with you. And one more thing I'd like to say. I actually don't share the optimism about what is happening or what we think is happening in Geneva, because I work with the opposition and I know what goes on behind the scenes. I believe that the ISSG now, I mean, of course, if the U.S. has leverage, then maybe you could do something through the ISSG. The day before yesterday, Russia, the American ambassador to Russia was interviewed. There was an exclusive interview with Voice of America. And he talked about Syria, he talked about a whole range of issues, and he said, we have been bending back over backwards, trying to get Russia involved in a variety of global issues, but the Russians have not been willing to engage with us. And you can also think back to the days when Mr. Obama proposed the so-called Russia reset policy. Because he came into office and he had this idea of, you know, we need to accommodate Russia and, you know, Russian sensibilities about a number of issues. And then if we do that, we can actually get the Russians to cooperate with us. What happened as a result? We got Ukraine. We got Crimea, you know, illegal annexation of Crimea in the 21st century. And then they were emboldened. They went all in Syria. So we didn't really get the cooperation that we were hoping for because we didn't have a backbone. I don't think you can get anything done with any... I'm not advocating for a major confrontation with Russia over Syria. But what I know for sure is that you cannot get much done with Russia from a position of weakness. You give Secretary Kerry leverage, and then the next time... And then the next time he picks up the phone to talk to Lavrov, then he has... you know, he has something to say, and Lavrov would have to listen. Putin, more importantly, would have to listen. Right now, I believe that the political track that we have, that actually does not exist, is providing cover to the emptying of the country, because we don't have a ceasefire on the ground. The Russians are bombing in Aleppo. Last week, the Russians bombed U.S.-backed forces on the borders with Iraq that are fighting ISIS. They're opposed to Assad, but they're not fighting Assad now, not because they're not opposed to Assad, but because they're further, way out on the borders with Iraq, and there's no presence for Assad troops there. So they're mainly focused on ISIS. The Russians bombed them. This is way away from ISIS areas. The Russians bombed them. The Americans expressed concern, and for the first time ever, scrambled jets to try and chase the Russian planes away. That was the first time anything like that had ever happened. And after the American jets went back to refuel, the Russians went back and they continued the bombing. So the end game is tenable for, if you put Russia in the driver's seat, some people say, you know what, let the Russians own it. If you put Russia in the driver's seat, you have to negotiate with Russia, for sure. But if you put them in the driver's seat, what is happening now is the end game is tenable for them. It's untenable for us because they're actually happy that, I'm sure that they're happy that the Brexit happened. I'm sure they're happy that the refugee crisis is splitting up Europe. I'm sure they're happy that they're trying to force the U.S. or create the perception internationally that Putin has forced President Obama to work with him and shift the focus away from Ukraine and what's happening in Europe. Their strategy is actually working for them. But I don't think it's working for Syrians. I don't think it's working for civilians. I don't think it's working for the United States. And the thing that worries me the most is that the only group that was not a signatory to the ceasefire, that was the Syrian Al-Qaeda affiliate, has actually benefited from the Russian campaign because they have suffered minimal losses. Recently, they made notable gains in the southern suburbs of Aleppo. A few days ago, they were making notable gains on the Syrian coast. So everyone now looks to them as the group that is effective on the battlefield.
And gains against ISIS.
Absolutely. Whereas those Free Syrian Army groups that signed onto the ceasefire, they actually got screwed. So this is not working. This is definitely not working for Europe. It's not working for the United States. It's not working for Syrians. It's working for Russia. It's working for Iran. And we need to recognize that the current policy is not working. And we need to recognize that it's high time that we employ the new strategy.
When you talk about end game is what? Assad stays in power? As far as Russia's concerned, that's their end game, right? I mean, yes. They may not love Assad, but they want a government in power, and it is the Assad government.
Yeah, I think you could say the same thing about the Iranians. Between the Russians and the Iranians, there's no particular respect or affection for Bashar al-Assad. In many respects, they see him as a problem child. But for Vladimir Putin in particular, for him personally, set aside conventional Russian interests, in a naval gas station in Tartus, traditional relationships with the Syrian military. This is very much about Vladimir Putin personally and about what he says to a country that is failing economically, that is in the grips of a major crisis, quite frankly, of alcohol poisoning, what he is able to say to the Russian people about Russia's comeback as a great power. This is what the intervention in Syria is really about for Vladimir Putin. What he told the United Nations a few days before the military intervention last September was, we are opposed to this program of the West of regime change and democratization in the Middle East. We're opposed to it. And Syria is the place where we intend to defeat the United States. I think what Putin wants at the end of the day here, the diplomatic brass ring for him, would be if President Barack Obama or President Obama's successor were to say, okay, you win, let me shake hands with Bashar al-Assad, and we'll work together to defeat ISIS. If that happens, Putin is able to tell the people of Russia, we won, we defeated the United States. But the problem is, even if that happens, the emptying of Syria will continue. The Bashar al-Assad regime is basically a mafia crime family, okay? I've got a daughter and son-in-law who live and work in Germany. They're sponsoring two Syrian families who basically walked all the way from Syria to Germany. These were families who were living in Assad, Syria. These were not people having to contend with barrel bombs and the like. They came to the conclusion, this country under Assad is finished. It's finished. We can't raise kids here. We can't make an honorable living. The whole economy is nothing but a gangster economy. These are the best and brightest of the country. What, one of these families is a husband-wife attorney team. Another family is headed by an engineer. They've come to Germany. They're learning German as fast as they can. They're determined to be good Germans. And this is the wave of the future. Turkey is not going to be able to continue to be a holding pen for the emptying of this country. And unless... One thing Peter said I'd really like to second, I think everyone in this room, those of us who are American citizens, can be intensely proud of the effort our Secretary of State, John Kerry, is making. He has nothing more than a smile and a shoeshine at his disposal right now. We had, you remember the Red Line incident of August, September 2013. We had a naval task force in the Eastern Mediterranean then. I think it was like 5 guided missile cruisers. I can tell you, without firing a single shot, if that naval task force were reconstituted now, Russia's foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov, would pay a lot closer attention to the Secretary of State of the United States. And we would have the attention of Vladimir Putin. Right now, John Kerry is trying to lower violence. In some cases, he's succeeded. He's trying to increase the flow of humanitarian assistance. In some cases, he's conceded. But he is basically empty-handed, attaching himself to the lapels of his Russian counterpart. There's been some speculation in the press over whether John Kerry actually supports this letter of these 51. I don't know the specific answer to that, but I do know he needs some leverage so he can work on our behalf.
Hear, hear. Yeah. Let me ask you, Mohammed, there, and then we'll go to questions, actually. The time has gone by so fast, but let me ask you, what is the state of what we know of what we've come to call the Free Syrian Army? And you know very well, it did not gain a great reputation in the early years, and I think most people, I actually would bet that most people think it doesn't even really exist, that it's all become Nusra Front or a a scraggly group of people that are left behind, unarmed and not very well trained. What is the story?
Well, the Free Syrian Army has definitely, especially since the Russians intervened in Syria, they have definitely suffered the most losses because the Russians went after them with spectacular firepower. So that is true. It's true that they have lost, substantially. That was not the case in 2012 because they were actually the dominant force. And at the time, different FSA groups were in control of at least half the country. Things changed when, in May of 2013 when Hezbollah, the Lebanese group Hezbollah, intervened in Syria and sent fighters into Syria at the behest of Iran. So do they exist now? Of course they do. Do we know that for sure? Of course we do. Does the U.S. Work with them? Yes, they work with some groups. I can name some. I can name Jabhat al-Shami. I can name the group that I just said were bombed by the Russians recently. That group that was bombed by the Russians recently actually recently captured a border crossing with Iraq from ISIS. Yesterday they seized some towns in eastern Syria from ISIS. They exist in Aleppo. They exist in southern Syria. Actually, in southern Syria, they're dominant. They're called the Southern Front, and they're the most dominant force. But ISIS has also been able to establish a foothold in southern Syria, and now not only do they have to worry about Assad in southern Syria, but they also close to the borders with Jordan and Israel. But they also have to worry about ISIS. So, are they still there? Of course, because most of them were signatories to the ceasefire, and actually the United States and Secretary Kerry was very interested in making sure that they sign onto the ceasefire, because the ceasefire meant that the guns should fall silent, and if the opposition had no guns, the U.S. would not have sought to broker a ceasefire with them. Now, here's the problem, though. In the Obama administration's approach to Syria since the beginning was one of containment. We don't have a horse to run in this fight. Syria is not strategically that important for us, so maybe we can try. So we're not going to do anything against the campaign of mass slaughter in Syria, but we're going to try and deal with the effects through humanitarian aid, through working supporting Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, those frontline states that had to do with this mass exodus of refugees. But this has failed spectacularly because of the Brexit, because of ISIS. ISIS was only able to surge across the border from Syria into Iraq and capture Mosul and become the global menace that you know now and inspire attacks all around the world and get the U.S. involved with billions of dollars on this bombing campaign after they conquered eastern Syria. So this, I think we need to dispel this myth of containment. Containment in Syria does not work. Containment in this interconnected, globalized world where mass slaughter is happening at an industrial scale does not work. And we need to confront, I know some may be dismayed that this is not the case and that we cannot contain what's happening in Syria or limit the effects to Syria's borders, but that's a reality and we need to deal with it. The main thing that we've struggled with is that since the beginning, because the policy was one of containment, was that the United States actually outsourced arming the moderate groups in Syria to Saudi, to Qatar. And at the time, things have improved recently between these two countries, but at the time they were competing, and they still are, but not as much as they used to. They were competing regionally. So they would support some groups in Syria, Qatar would support some groups in Syria, and they would say, on the condition that you do not work with groups supported by Saudi. And Saudi would do the same. So this created divisions on the ground. This actually undermined the command and control structure that we were trying to create, because that aid and lethal aid bypassed the command and control structure that was led at the time by General Idris, a defector from Assad's military, and it went straight to certain groups in the country. And Saudi and Qatar was not they were not the only two countries guilty of that. The U.S. also sometimes bypassed that and worked directly with groups on the ground. To the point that in 2016, believe it or not, in Syria, groups backed by the Department of Defense clash with groups backed by the CIA. This is what we're dealing with in Syria now. So sometimes, you know, we get criticisms and the opposition is not perfectly united. They sometimes quarrel. This is all true. But what can I do when DOD goes to war with the CIA in Syria?
I'm going to take your questions. I have one question. I don't know if there's a quick answer, but I do think it's worth asking. Regardless of how we got here, if the Assad government fell tomorrow, if Russia, it won't do this, but if it were to fall tomorrow, would Syria be a failed state? Is there any possibility there'd be a government
I would say that Syria is already a failed state. For all we know, Bashar al-Assad, who is still able to indulge in his bicycling hobby, could fall off his bicycle tomorrow and have a heart attack and die, okay? That, in essence, is pretty much the end of the regime, because whatever legitimacy still resides in this regime, it resides in the person of Bashar al-Assad, because he's the heir to his father, Hafez al-Assad. If Assad were to leave tomorrow, this does not mean that there's an ISIS victory parade down Main Street, Damascus, okay? ISIS is under military pressure. It's located fundamentally far off in eastern Syria. There would be a lot of pushing and tugging if Assad, and better yet, if the family should disappear. But the Syrian army would still exist. There are elements of the Syrian army that the Assad regime has refused to commit to combat because they know that these units are not into mass slaughter of civilians, okay? So there is a very good possibility that if the family can be moved aside somehow, elements of the existing Syrian army and elements of the Free Syrian Army can work together, establish some kind of a military command council or something in Damascus, and carry on the fight both against the Nusra Front and ISIS.
Rene, can I add just one thought? And I'm not weighing into this American debate, which I think is a worthy debate of military action, yes or no. We all know it's a very complicated decision to take to intervene militarily, and there's a whole spectrum of measures from arming the opposition to establishing a safe zone to targeting directly the Assad regime. I just want to say that one should not succumb to the temptation to think that you can win this militarily, that you can sort of bomb yourself to peace. I think we need, in the end, also a political track, a political solution, and we need to deal with some rather unsavory partners in this. You know, all the stakeholders in the region have to be part of that dialogue. Other than that, you will never be able to create a sustainable peace for Syria. And it means we have to sometimes make huge concessions on our partners in that region. But I think that's indispensable, and that's the price we will have to pay if there is, in the end, maybe in many, many years, a true political peace for Syria.
I mean, I think we agree. I think all of us agree on that, that there's not a military solution. But back to your question of Assad, what would happen if he were gone tomorrow? I think the administration won't say it, but their lesson from both Iraq and Afghanistan is better Assad still in power than the chaos if he's not there. Right? They would like a negotiated solution, but absent a negotiated solution, better Assad's still in power than the alternative. I think our both Fred and I, the position that we've been advancing is that's not actually true. You're better off doing something that threatens Assad directly and giving yourself the leverage to broker that political solution, either with Assad or whoever is left, because there will be people in control of that part of Syria, whether it's Assad's family or not. So you actually have to be willing to threaten Assad to get to the political solution, whereas the administration's view is we can't risk Assad falling because what will come will be worse. It's hard to imagine what would be worse. Every year we say, oh, the terrible, but look at where we are. We have a country of 22 million people that is a failed state, hemorrhaging people and nurturing ISIS in the middle of the most strategic region of the world right now.
We probably have time for just about two questions, so I'll point to the closest gentleman right there. And
so, okay. Hi, just a quick comment and then question, which is I'm not sure if I completely agree with the premise that Assad is solely responsible for the 13 million refugees. Certainly we have our hand in that. There was a two-part series in the Washington Post about Hillary's role in terms of unleashing Turkey and Saudis and Qatar into the region and fomenting trouble. But the question is, topically, about an hour ago, Russia lifted sanctions against Turkey. Turkey apologized yesterday for the downing of the jet. I address this to our German friend here. How does that play into the Syrian conflict in terms of the Russia-Erdogan-Putin relationship? Has he come to an understanding that has Erdogan finally backed off and realized that he's going to have to play ball with the Russians on this issue?
Well, I think it's the result of some deep thinking by the Turkish leadership. They were left with very few friends in the region. Look at their neighbors, Syria, Iraq, Iran. And they fell out with Russia. Now they've taken two important steps, embark on a road to reconciliation with Israel, and have a arrangement with Russia. I think this was a little bit of realpolitik, if I may say so, on the part of the Turkish leader. He knows that he lives in a tumultuous region, and his only friend is, if you will, Europe, with whom Erdogan also undertakes rather tenuous and sometimes relations fraught with conflict. So I think this is a move to make his life easier in the region. Probably helps a little bit to diffuse this dangerous tension between Russia and Turkey, and this was a tension that also was militarily very dangerous and could lead to some unintended military confrontation. So it's a good piece of news from our point of view.
Go ahead. Mohammed was.
I've worked very closely with the State Department for over 5 years now on Syria, engaged them very, very closely. I worked with the State Department also, not just under Secretary Kerry, but also under Secretary Clinton. For me, this is not a partisan debate. Syria is not a partisan issue for me. It's a human rights issue. But I can tell you with full confidence that Secretary Clinton and whatever she did when she was at the State Department was not in any way, shape, or form responsible for mass exodus of refugees in Syria, simply because, as a Syrian, I can tell you that Syrians are leaving Syria en masse because of two things, artillery and aerial bombardment. Saudi doesn't have an air force in Syria. Qatar doesn't have an air force in Syria. Yeah, they may have supported different desperate groups, etc., but that is not the reason why people are leaving the country. They're leaving the country because they don't have answer to the to aerial bombardment. This is what has precipitated this refugee crisis.
We may just have one question over there.
Yes, thank you for coming. I really enjoyed this panel. My question is more focused on the one actor that a lot of people don't talk about, which is Jordan, which I really feel bad for. They're overwhelming all the Syrian refugees, the security, border security issues, et cetera, et cetera. And they're doing a lot in terms of trying to build a southern buffer zone along Syria, but I just wanted to understand why there's not that many comments about Jordan's role. Is it because their economy is not too good, or don't know, but it seems like they're a great way to kind of enable to help with this fight against Assad or ISIS. Thank you.
I can just, I mean, Jordan has taken the, as a percentage of its population, the number of refugees in Jordan are the equivalent of all of Canada moving to the United States. All of Canada. Everybody moving south. Can you imagine what that would do to our schools, to our houses, to our social systems? So the burden's incredible, and we're aware of it. We're trying to help the Jordanians support, you know, in the camps, and a lot of Syrians are not in camps. They're living with family. They're in the cities, and we're trying to deal with that from a aid point of view, from a humanitarian point of view. And we're well aware that Jordan is fragile to begin with between traditional Jordanian tribes and Palestinians. So I think the State Department's well aware of it, but I'm not sure, again, what else we can do other than to address the conflict at the core more in the way we've been talking about.
So, and militarily, Jordan played a key role in supporting FSA groups, Free Syrian Army, or opposition groups in the south. That's why the Free Syrian Army actually, the only area in Syria where the Free Syrian Army now is dominant and has the upper hand is the south. However, you know, this is all part of the bigger picture here is that the U.S. that works with Jordan on supporting those groups never intended for those groups to actually inflict serious losses on the Assad regime in a way that would threaten Damascus. They're very close to Damascus. So there was never, we never had the intention of having them march on Damascus. Because we wanted a stalemate in the country. It's like we get a military stalemate, people realize there's no military solution, and then they work towards a political solution. Now, of course, that all changed with, again, Hezbollah in Iran, and then more recently with the Russian intervention. So this has failed. But, so Jordan has played a role, but within, there were constraints on the role they could play. And recently, because ISIS has been able to establish a foothold in the south, ISIS was able to carry out a bombing against the borders with Jordan, and Jordan, as a result, shut down the border. So it's very tricky for the Jordanian king. You know, he comes to Washington, D.C. often, and, you know, he in the past came with a map, and he was advocating for a no-fly zone in the south, and he wrote an op-ed in The Guardian in support of a no-fly zone, in support of those groups, but there was no appetite in Washington, D.C.
Is there a yes or no question out there? wave both of your hands.
There's one over there.
Okay, he has a yes or no question.
Simple yes or no.
Okay.
I've listened to a panel of four people, and there's no daylight between their opinions. My question is, why didn't you have a more balanced presentation? Even Megyn Kelly knows how to do it on Fox News. Where is the opposition?
I think you might have a hard
time. Because 5.5 years into this, everyone agrees what the right thing to do in Syria is, I guess.
I would say one thing. I said there were no answers. And actually, I don't think we've heard answers up here. We've heard a presentation of where we've gotten to in 5.5 years. And I think we'll have to leave it at that, actually, because we have run out of time. Oh, there's somebody that they would like to answer a question to for. He's a composer, yeah. He'll be playing in an hour.
Yeah, I'm playing in like 15 minutes. My name is Malik Jandari. I'm an American Syrian composer and pianist. I have a question for Fred Hoff, which I respect you a lot. I was actually born in Germany, ambassador, so I'm half German. The question is, my government, the government of the United States, listed the Assad dictatorship, Hafez al-Assad, as a state sponsor of terrorism. Anybody can tell me when? What year?
82, right?
December 1979. I was 7 years old. And the question to Fred Hoff and to the administration, because I'm not a politician, what have we done since December 1979 to bring this killer of children to justice?
Yeah.
I think for me that's probably a pretty awkward question because when I came into the Obama administration in April 2009, I came in as a deputy to George Mitchell, our special envoy for Middle East peace, and my job was try to arrange as quietly as possible a treaty of peace between Israel and Syria. And as of March 2011, we had managed to stay out of the newspapers, but some real progress toward this end had been made. Our theory of the case was a treaty of peace between Syria and Israel would be very bad news for Iran. It could be conceivably good news for people inside Syria looking for a relaxation in the permanent state of siege in the country. Unfortunately, when the problems in Deraa started, when these kids were being tortured by the security assets of the regime, that possibility went away. When it became very clear that Bashar al-Assad, instead of trying to come up with a political solution, instead of going down to Deraa and sitting with the people whose kids had been beaten up and saying, look, I am the president of this republic. My first duty is to protect you. Now, I want peace and quiet around here, but there are going to be people in the security services arrested. Some of them are going to be sent away. And by the way, here's some compensation for your trouble. He had this option. He had this option. If he had taken it, it is quite possible, by no means for sure, but it's possible that by the end of 2011, there could have been a treaty of peace in the Middle East would be looking a whole lot different than it is now. So I think a lot of missed opportunities. It's a real tragedy here.
Ambassador Peter Wittig, Ambassador Fred Hoff, Anne-Marie Slaughter, Mohammed Ghanem, thank you all very much for joining us. Our time is out. We thank all of you.